Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Talking Investment Management Podcast. I'm Dave Grimm, a partner here at Stradley Ronan, and I'm really excited to be joined by my colleague and partner, Jan Felina. She serves as the co-chair of our Securities and Regulatory Enforcement Practice, and Buddy Donahue, who is a current fund director, the former director of the SEC's Division of Investment Management, as well as the chief of staff at the SEC, and a good friend. Jan, Buddy, so thrilled to have you here today. And with the Independent Directors Council 2025 conference just right around the corner, thought it would be a great time to sit down with both of you and talk about some of the issues that matter most to fund directors. So we're going to dive into how the SEC's exams and enforcement play into the picture, looking back at the history of regulatory scrutiny on fund directors, and talk about what it's really like to be under the examination and enforcement microscope. We'll also share some strategies for hopefully staying out of those situations and some practical steps directors can take when enforcement actions can't be avoided. We're also going to spend a few minutes on what can be expected from enforcement and exams at the current SEC. So with that as a windup, Buddy, let's turn it to you. We'd love to hear a bit about your background, including your time at the SEC, recognizing that it's not just about the SEC with you. You've spent time in sort of all the important chairs when it comes to these issues. And so it'd be great to hear some about your background. And also, if you can give us some historical perspective, how did we get to this point? Some examples of past cases where fund directors faced enforcement or other regulatory challenges.
Happy thank you so much for the invite to talk about this topic that I know is on the minds of many of the independent directors, probably most independent directors that sit on boards. I've been in the industry now for 15 years. I graduated law school in 75 and went into the industry right away. And as I think back, I mean, I've sat in virtually every chair around this table when you talk about funds and directors and regulators and managers. As you mentioned before, I mean, I was the division director for the investment management division at the SEC, and I was chief of staff there. So I have the regulator's perspective to a large extent. You know, I was outside attorney. I was a partner at Morgan Lewis for a while, and I was a senior counsel at Shaman and Sterling. Most of my career was management. Early on in my career, I was president and actually a director of a small fund family. I was executive vice president, general counsel at Oppenheimer Funds. I was global general counsel at Merrill Lynch Investment Managers. And I was investment company general counsel at Goldman Sachs. So I have a little bit of experience with different firms and the approaches that those firms wound up taking. I've been a director, really, of closed-end funds, open-end funds, and a BDC. I was chairman of and a board member of private funds located in Cayman Islands. And I've sat on as a board member of UCITS, both Dublin-based and Luxembourg-based. I've been an independent director of the Oppenheimer Funds, and I'm currently an independent director of two of the clusters, really, the BNY Mellon Funds. I also been on the board of the Mutual Fund Directors Forum for a number of years, and last couple of years, I was chair of that board, and I've been an adjunct professor teaching investment management for probably 10 years at Brooklyn Law School and more recently at Rutgers. A lot of seats, and I try not to get confused at times because I guess I could wind up, but I wind up with a fair amount of experience, and I look at issues really from a number of different perspectives, which I think can be quite helpful. There haven't been that many cases that have been brought against independent directors of funds, but that doesn't keep directors from necessarily worrying about the fact that they may be one that a case winds up bringing. So I'll mention a few of the cases. There was a case in 2012, really about against eight directors, really related to Morgan Keegan funds and valuation. And, very unfortunate. And there were cases, the SEC had previously brought a case against the manager and some others about the same issue with the same funds. A 2013 case against Morgan Lights funds and independent directors there. A little background, I think there were 71 different series that the directors were supposed to be reviewing information in connection with the renewal of their advisory contracts. And you know, that can be quite a difficult task where you have that many funds, that many different sub-advisors, and the renewals that were taking place. 2015, you had the Commonwealth Capital case. And once again, that was a, I would say it was a 15C case, but it really was, among other things, if I recall correctly, about much of the information they had requested, or some of the information they had requested in connection with the renewal of the advisory contract, they had not actually received, and actually indicated they had received it, relied upon it in their renewals. And then, you know, more recently, I think there was a case brought in 2023, which had further action in 2025 Pinnacle, where there was a case that was brought against, I think it was two independent directors for actually aiding and abetting. And now I'm going to turn on that one to Jen, because Jen, you were actually the lawyer that actually was able to have that case dismissed against them. And so, Jen, if you want to jump in and maybe talk a little bit about that case, and then you know, we can get back to the other things I'm supposed to talk about.
Thanks, buddy. It's great to have you. And thanks, Dave, for getting us kicked off here. Yeah, the Pinnacle case was unique in many ways. I think one of the things it did is it demonstrated to the industry that independent directors can find themselves in the crosshairs of the SEC. And that's exactly what happened in that case. It also was a good lesson in understanding that the board's obligations under the federal securities laws are specific and limited. Board's obligations under state securities laws and state laws can be more broad, can be, but the SEC cannot enforce those obligations. And this was a case where the specific oversight obligations of the board fell under what is known as the liquidity rule. And the boards have three very specific obligations under the liquidity rule that the SEC has called their oversight obligation. And interestingly, in that case, the independent trustees met all three of those obligations. In order to bring that enforcement action, the SEC had to allege that they aided and abetted others in not appropriately designating the assets in the fund in the correct liquidity categories. And that's where things sort of went awry. Interestingly, though, aiding and abetting, not just for independent trustees, but really for any individuals in an SEC enforcement case, is not an easy standard for the SEC to hit. And these independent trustees had a very robust defense on that substantive charge. However, this was also a case that demonstrates what happens when the legal landscape surrounding the SEC changes during the course of the case. Here, the liquidity rule was a new rule. On behalf of the independent trustees, we challenged the rule. It was a secondary argument, and the Supreme Court struck down Chevron deference in the courts to the SEC's ability to interpret the federal securities laws. And instead, the court asked us to rebrief the matter under the new standard, post-Chevron, under Loper-Bright, and we did that. And that's ultimately what won the day for the independent trustees, because the SEC dismissed the case. The risk to the SEC of losing yet another rule in 1 year, where they had lost four already, was just too much. But I think the case taught the industry a lot of lessons about, one, really looking to see whether the SEC has the authority it claims it has, whether your individuals actually violated the law, and whether the SEC can meet the standards and the elements of the particular offenses. So I'm going to send it back to Buddy and Dave for the next topic.
Yeah, great, great stuff, Jan. And Buddy, just ping-ponging it back to you, I'd love to get your take on the Pinnacle case, but also the other cases that you listed there, right? You've seen a lot of them. You sat in all those different chairs, as you talked about. Do you have lessons learned or practical takeaways for directors as you think back on that enforcement history?
I do. And I've thought a lot about, you know, the whole issue of potential liability really for directors from SEC perspective or from litigation. generally. And yeah, I'll start off by saying, listen, Jan, in deference to you, you know, it's nice that you won the case, but if you're a director, you don't want to be in that case, right?
Exactly.
So for many of us, it really is a question of, okay, how do I avoid having to hire Jan to get me out? I just want to avoid being in. And so I think as I look at some of the cases that were brought, you know, they first thing is on the valuation cases, there's only three real provisions in the 1940 Act that actually give directors specific responsibilities and things they have to do. One of them is the determination of fair value if you went under 2A41 and then the rule 2A5. And, you know, there's the requirements on the 15A, B, and C. Directors have responsibility for approving the advisory contract, to approving the underwriting contract. And on under C, where directors have responsibility for requesting information from the advisor relative to the renewal of the contracts. And the advisor has responsibility to provide that information. And then the independent directors have the responsibility for, as independent directors, approving the advisory and the underwriting contracts. And then there's a requirement, really, for the independent directors to approve under Section 32A, the appointment of the independent public accountants for the fund. And you can go searching all you want on the 40 Act. You're not going to find much more of that there. You know, if you start, there's probably over 50 rules that give directors some level of responsibilities, whether it's approval, oversight, or otherwise, for them to pick up responsibilities for doing things. So, you know, that's the regulatory landscape that you wind up being under. What I find interesting about, and in some ways scary about the Pinnacle case, is that it was aiding and abetting. And so it wasn't even that they could say the directors didn't do something that they were required to do, but rather, supposedly, I guess, they were aiding and abetting somebody else doing something that they shouldn't have been doing. And I think directors would find that troubling in terms of a regulatory approach to something where the regulator didn't decide that they had a specific obligation that they didn't comply with, but you know, rather that for some reason they thought they should have been in a position to maybe have prevented that from happening. There's certain areas I always think as a regulator you care about. Valuation, I would say, is one of them. You know, it's an extraordinarily important area, particularly for open-end funds. People are transacting on those, and you need to make sure that, in fact, assets and liabilities are being properly valued. So, and directors, by statute, are given that responsibility where there aren't readily available market quotations for portfolio security. So it doesn't surprise me that directors may not have been, in a regulated view, doing their job properly. That they might decide that that's an area they want to pursue. I do think that the regulators will be somewhat reluctant to bring cases against directors. And that was my experience, and that's why the aiding and abetting part really troubles me a bit. Because the recognition, it's a difficult job, and you want to make sure that you can attract the best people to be there. And, you know, so, you know, they want to make sure that they're not doing, you know, anything that would discourage really good directors from you know, taking on the role and doing their job properly. Going forward, I just think that it's likely that a lot of the cases that the SEC might consider winning would be what I would call process cases. So if you think about the valuation cases that were brought, you know, they were not about the fact that the value that the board gave to a particular instrument was wrong, right? So it'd be hard for the SEC actually to make that case because it's the statute is fair value as determined, you know, in good faith by the directors. So it really is that the process they used to reach or didn't use, the process they didn't use to reach that determination. And that's an easier case to burn, right? Because you can actually go through and say whatever. And there's any number of if you would, regulations I'm adopted to actually tell you what you have to do. And if that's the case, you better make sure that actually you're following exactly what the regulation says you have to do. Or alternatively, cases could be brought based on your failure to follow your own procedures. Where you yourself have essentially said, here's how we're going to do something. And then as you wind up in a situation where you're addressing that very specific issue, you don't do what you said you were going to do. And so I think there's a degree of diligence I think that we all should have as we're looking at our role as directors to make sure that not only we're doing the right thing, but that we're doing it in the right way. And I think that's a combination of what we said we'd do, what we disclosed we would do, and also what we may be required to do by, you know, either by our own policies and procedures or by rules that have been adopted or statutory provisions that wind up in place. Now, if I'm an independent director, and I am an independent director, one of the things I really do is rely a lot on my counsel. I rely on my counsel and I rely on the management company to really help me make sure that in effect, I've done the things that I need to do. I've done within the time frame I have to do them. And I've done them in the manner and approach with the information I need to have to do them effectively. And so, yeah, as I look at these cases, I look at them and I say, it's unfortunate. I don't feel good about the cases having been brought. But I do recognize that independent directors have incredibly important responsibilities. And the SEC and investors rely on us doing our job properly. And so I think we need to make sure that, in fact, you know, we earn that trust and we do things that we're supposed to do in the way in which we're supposed to do them. David and Jan, I don't know if that answers the question, but that's the approach that I wind up and the observations I wind up taking from you. I would also point out that there was a 33 Act case or a 34 Act case that came up where an independent director, not a fun case, but was less than forthcoming about a personal relationship that he had with management. And that really didn't enable either the shareholders for the fund or the directors or their counsel or management to ascertain whether or not he really was an independent director. And like the SEC, brought an action against him based on that. And he wound up having to, settle with the SEC. So, not all the cases are going to be, 40 Act type cases. If you have a fund director, you oversee a lot of different areas and you have policies and procedures, that you've adopted and made sure were adopted under 38A1 to prevent violation of federal securities laws. And now I think you ought to be mindful that we just ought to always be diligent about what we're doing. I think there's a lot of them going to be process cases, and a lot of them likely will either be relying on or use as a mode of settlement, really to compliance rule 38A1. Fortunately, I don't have a lot of experience in terms of enforcement actions against independent directors, other than observing them when I was at the commission and reading them after I, before I was there and then after I've left. But Jan, what do you think? I mean, in that regard.
Yeah, buddy, thanks. It's interesting. I think we've seen Chair Atkins in a couple of speeches now indicate what he's really looking to do in terms of enforcement. And even if it doesn't focus on independent trustees specifically, I think what he has to say is important for board, because what we will see and what we saw sort of in the last administration under Chair Clayton is investment management will be a focus, because that's where retail investors are. And Chair Atkins in particular is going to focus on protecting retail investors. And the way to do that is really through the 240 Act. My suspicion is there's going to be a focus there once again. In fact, the investment management case numbers under Clayton were actually higher than they were under Gensler. So if that's any indication. The other thing is, he has been, Chair Atkins has been quite clear about being less prescriptive about products that can be offered, programs, what retail investors are permitted to invest in. And that is certainly a priority for this commission. But what will also have to be a priority are disclosures. Because if you're going to allow market access to more products, you have to make sure the market has accurate information. And that's an easy one, because that's right squarely in both of the 40 Acts, the 33 and the 34 Act. So I think we're going to see a real emphasis on disclosure, which means as lawyers and as board members, we have to be aware of what the requirements are in disclosure cases and where there really is still a lot of room for the law to develop. So you mentioned valuation, Buddy. I think valuation still could be an important point for this commission because it goes to the value of the fund. And that's what investors are looking at. That has to be correct. However, as you also point out, valuation cases are very difficult for the SEC to bring as a substantive matter because of the way the courts have defined valuation as an opinion and not a fact. So now the question is, do you bring cases under the compliance rule? Do you bring cases under sort of in technical violation areas? I think not. I think we're going to see less of that in enforcement. But that raises the next question. Can we actually do enforcement at the SEC now without bringing enforcement action? And the answer to that is yes. And I think Buddy and Dave can both speak to this. There's an exam program. And at least two of the three commissioners, the Republican commissioners, have been pretty outspoken about how many violations, potential violations, borderline violations can be dealt with effectively in the exam program. Also important during that process that your response to deficiency letters appropriately address those so that you satisfy the commission. Because if they want to avoid enforcement actions, that is really now the place to do it. And again, individual accountability, I think, is going to take priority over cases against entities and high penalties. And penalties are going to go back to where they were when Chair Atkins was on the commission, where they have to be tailored, they have to be within the statutory limits, and they cannot harm shareholders. So from the board's perspective, you could be looking at those things if, in fact, you have an issue that is coming before you when we're talking about penalties.
Jan, those are very, very interesting points. And, you know, the point about the examination program, I think, is an important one. It's been, you can look at that favorably and say that rather than having to go through, you know, enforcement actions or and the bad outcomes that can come from that, things can be disposed of, you know, at the examination phase in a hopefully satisfactory manner. You know, having spent most of my career in management, I mean, you didn't want to have to resolve them at a higher level. If you could resolve something at the examination level, that was really what you sought to do. There is a concern, a counter concern, if you would, which is also that the examination process can wind up really being its own regulatory regime, where in fact the new rules, if you would, are being determined by the examiners. By the way, who are not the investment management division, they're not commissioners, they're not the regulatory division that's supposed to have responsibility, you know, for developing those, but they're rather the examination area and the way they possibly believe things should evolve. And that's a counter to that. And I would encourage people to be careful in that arena. But you can easily see where you would agree to do something that maybe you're not obligated to do. if in fact you wind up not having to address either that or a different issue, if you would, in the what can be the more troublesome enforcement arena. So yes, there is the advantage that you can maybe dispose of things at the examination phase, but there's also a concern that in fact, you know, you're developing, the new rules, if you would, without the opportunity for notice and comment and the regulatory action actually having taken place. And, you know, concern that I would have there, with that proposal. I would also point out, I think, you know, that there's one of the philosophical issues that I had seen when I was at the commission and that I can appreciate is the fact that, you know, frequently where there's been a violation, the action by the SEC against the entity that actually was harmed by the violation or the shareholders, wind up imposing a fine on that very entity and hurting shareholders even more. And that's part of, I know that the current chairman of the SEC, has made that comment, you know, when he was a commissioner, I'm sure still feels that way. You know, you shouldn't be harming the shareholders really of a company that was harmed twice. They already suffered because something that happened shouldn't have happened. And, you know, now you're imposing a fine on them also or some other complication. And therefore, your alternative is to make sure you're holding individuals responsible. And, I do believe it likely will be directors. I also note that if you're going to make a number of less liquid type investments available to retail investors, valuation is going to be a key. Disclosure, Jan, as you had mentioned, is going to be a key. And you're going to have to make sure that, in fact, the investors that are making choices are making the correct choices. The people that are responsible for making sure the assets are being valued properly are doing that properly. That I think increasingly will be a challenge for some board members and something that board members, council, management companies, and everybody needs to work together and make sure you get it right.
Yeah, great stuff from both of you. Thanks for all that. Jan, one thing that I wanted to ask you, we've talked some about, you know, trying to avoid getting in the crosshairs of the SEC, right? But sometimes you get in the crosshairs despite your best intentions, right? And you just had a front row seat where that happened with your clients. And, you know, I'd love it if you could just share with us, like, how does that feel, right? Like, what does it feel like? And like, practically, if you're a director that, you know, ends up in that unfortunate seat, what are some things, some practical things they can sort of do to get themselves out of that seat, hopefully?
Sure. Yeah, this was a really interesting perspective for me. When I was inside the SEC and the SEC would sue individuals, I always thought, wow, you know, it's a tough pill to swallow when you're named as a defendant in an SEC action. Having the front row seat to actually defending that was similar. Independent trustees or individuals in any position feel as if it is almost a personal attack on their abilities as either a chief executive officer, a chief financial officer, or as a director. They feel as if their reputations are impugned. And in a sense, they are. There is a press release that comes out from the SEC. It details the SEC's version of what they feel was wrong. And it doesn't make you as an individual look very good career-wise or other. So how do you get on top of that? You have to stay one step ahead of the regulator. That's key. You have to be thinking ahead of where they are. What are the defenses? Where are the holes in the case? And how are you able to capitalize on that? There is a defense to every SEC action. It's just a matter of finding it. You have to keep the lines of communication open, especially when you're dealing with independent trustees who, again, are not necessarily steeped in the industry. They are not lawyers and they are not regulators. So your job as counsel is to educate them as best you can on what the law actually requires them to do, what they did, and whether or not it complied. And you have to be in a receive information and listening mode from them so you can fully understand how they were operating and what the facts are surrounding this violation that may or may not be provided to you either from the SEC during a Wells process or in the complaint when it's finally filed. And then you have to assess and reassess the merits of the case, your defenses in the case, and how is the law developing while you may be litigating the case. As I said, that was key here. And being able to pivot from what might have been at the outset your strongest argument to a secondary argument that now becomes the strongest argument because things have changed. If you are unable to pivot in those circumstances, you can't adequately represent your clients or take advantage of what is really a changing environment. What are some practical steps, though, when you are not in an enforcement action, but you as a board can envision an enforcement action? I think there, and this is sort of advice that I typically give, and that is, what is the potential violation? What are the elements of that violation and how will the regulator establish the violation against you, against your fund, against your advisor, whoever it may be? And walk backward and take actions that will alleviate and eliminate the SEC's ability to hit those elements. So you're preventing a claim from ever actually developing or ripening into something that can be filed in a complaint in an enforcement action against. And look, I'm not here to say perfection is going to be achieved. Perfection is not the standard, though, under the federal securities laws. But understanding how to avoid a level of imperfection that can result in liability is what is key here. And again, to Buddy's point, this is your counsel. This is your asset manager. These are your fund managers working together to identify what the issue is and resolve it before you get to an enforcement action.
Dan, those are really, really good points. Now, as a director, you could give me really, really good advice when I'm in the barrel, being shot at, where my only goal is to get out of the barrel. David, you likely would be the one who would give me superior advice about how never to be in the barrel to begin with. And I think, that for me, that's always been the way that I look at it, is I don't want to be in the barrel. Jan, you gave some really good advice on, as they're trying to put you in, maybe how you can keep them from actually doing that. And I think I've always relied on really good counsel and really good management to be very thoughtful about the role that they're putting directors in, the responsibilities that directors have. And then basically how to make sure that the manner in which the board is operating, independent directors are making decisions, being asked to do things, is being done properly so that the ability, if you would, for the regulator to try and put you in the barrel is really diminished to a great extent.
Agree 100%. Buddy, I think you put it so well earlier, right? When you're talking about staying out of the barrel, like the continued focus on process, right? That's where the focus of the commission has been. That's where it's going to be. And what does your procedure say? Are you following it? What does your disclosure say? Are you following it? A continued focus on that it's so critical to staying out of the barrel. Not that we don't love working with you, Jan, right? But let's try to keep it from getting there, right? All right.
I would point out, it's unfortunate that it really is, kind of the check the box kind of approach, as opposed to what's really important. But that, I think is the world that we live in. And we can always take care of the really important stuff as directors. We just have to make sure we're also checking all the boxes.
Well said. So as a way of wrapping us up here, we've spent a little bit of time already, I think, prognosticating about what's going to be coming down the pike from the SEC. But I want to just wrap by coming back to that and seeing if there's any other points we want to share with our audience on what we're going to be looking at in the coming years here. And just I'll kick it off by noting that Chairman Atkins at the SEC himself was a fund director. And I think that's an excellent thing for all fund directors, right? It gives him a perspective that will inform his, you know, how he thinks about these issues. So that's a really good thing about Chairman Atkins. And then the other point that I just wanted to highlight is that in the last administration, there was quite a bit of focus on potential 15C related cases. And pleased to report that so far, none of that has come to fruition. Let's hope it stays that way with the new administration. So that's a couple of things I've been thinking about in terms of looking forward. Buddy, how about you? Anything else that we haven't covered in terms of today's SEC and looking forward that you would share with our audience?
I think you've done an excellent job, and you and Jan in particular pointing out issues, observed really since the creation really of the asset management unit inside enforcement that there had been an increased focus, if you would, on the advisor and the fund arena. In terms of the way that everyone is complying with the rules and the laws that are applicable. And I think the size of that unit will have a lot to do with the focus really of enforcement on that particular area. And the focus went up in that area significantly when that unit was created. I liken it to the fact that you have regulatory enforcement lawyers that can only fish in certain ponds, and the pond they have is asset management. And so that's where they're fishing, and they want to get the biggest fish they can. So if that unit winds up being expanded or reduced or whatever, I think it'll have some influence, if you would, on the number and types of cases that are being brought.
Excellent point. Agree 100%. Jan, how about you in terms of looking ahead? Anything else you would add to what you've shared previously?
Yeah, I would add, I think Chair Atkins made an interesting comment, Dave, and you pointed this out too the other week, how he was looking for the SEC to secure judicial opinions to interpret the law for the SEC and establish guidelines for the agency. I found that interesting because if enforcement is going to go down, that's not consistent with securing judicial opinions. So it'd be interesting to see if he doesn't bring some cases to try to obtain judicial opinions to really settle the law in some areas where it's still pretty uncertain. The other point I'll make is the SEC, with respect to fund directors, I suspect will be looking for fund directors to assist rather than assume the liability of, all of the violations of an investment advisor and their fund. But private lawsuits will not be so forgiving or understanding. And that's where I think you could still be, as an independent director, at risk.
Excellent. Well, I think that is a good place to bring today's conversation to a close. We've obviously covered a lot of different ground, recent shifts at the SEC, what it feels like to be on the other side of an enforcement action, how trustees can manage that risk, and what to watch for going forward. Buddy and Jan, you guys have just been superb. It's been an absolute treat to talk about this with you. And we're looking forward to keeping this dialogue going as we get ready for the IDC conference coming up here soon. We'd love to connect with you out there if you're there. In the meantime, if you need more information, feel free to reach out to any of us. Take a look at stradley.com. Thanks everyone for listening, and hope you have a terrific day.
Jan and David, thank you.
Thank you.
From obtaining industry first exemptive and no action relief to assisting in the development of novel products, we have helped our clients become and remain industry leaders. We touch trillions worth of assets as counsel to more than half of the top 20 U.S. fund firms, serve as counsel to independent directors to more than 100 fund groups, and represent more than 40 fund sponsors. Learn more about us at stradley.com.